ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Dr. Norman Swan is my guest today in a conversation that we recorded in the middle of the pandemic. Norman has been a highly respected colleague of mine at the ABC for many years, but it was COVID-19 that catapulted him into the role of one of Australia's most well-known and most trusted voices. And CoronaCast, the pandemic podcast that he created with Tegan Taylor, had a huge following and won a Walkley Award. But Norman's medical interests are much broader than the coronavirus. He's written a general health guide covering everything from diet to sex to what he calls the well-being thing. And it has a characteristically pugnacious title, So You Think You Know What's Good For You. The stellar career that Norman has built for himself in Australia is not what onlookers might have predicted for the young Norman Swirsky, who was born into a working-class Jewish family in Glasgow. Before the pandemic, you took a trip to trace the origins of your family's history. Where did you go?
I went to Odessa. So my family, essentially, all of my family, arrived in Scotland at various times, but from the Jewish Pale of Settlement in what's now Ukraine, Lithuania, was before that Soviet Union, then Russia. And that's where they came from various parts. My paternal grandmother came from a little village called Dvinsk. My paternal grandfather came from Vilnius, and my maternal grandmother came from Odessa. She was a baby when she came after the pogroms in 1905. And her brothers and sisters came out as well. And some of her older brothers remembered Odessa. And they talked about it. So there was a lot of talk at the table. And I've always had this kind of romantic or idea of Odessa.
What kind of things did they say, Norman? What do you remember them saying about it? It does have one of those sort of mythical names, Odessa.
Yeah, it wasn't fondly remembered. You know, one of the brothers had to escape being conscripted into the Russian army. My great-grandfather on that side died during a pogrom, which is why they escaped. I mean, in both sides of my family didn't like talking about the past that much. They were very forward-focused. So there were just these fragments of conversation. There was no in-depth conversation about but it was a name that was discussed and mentioned, and how they'd got on a boat on the Black Sea at Odessa and landed in Glasgow thinking they were landing in America.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was a common story. And actually, going back to Odessa, I heard... We had this fantastic guide. When I say we, there's a group of guys that I grew up with in Britain who spread all over the world. And we get to, you know, pre-COVID, we got together once a year. And one of the others in the group, his family came from Odessa too. So the other three of them went along with us on this journey of discovery. So we got the story of what actually happened, because it's a very common story about Jews arriving in Britain thinking they were in America. And what happened was they either got on a ship in the Baltic or in the Black Sea, and the West Coast ports in Britain were where they commonly stopped before going across the Atlantic. And so there are, you know, Liverpool and Manchester have got very big Jewish populations. Glasgow had quite a big Jewish population. And the story was that they'd been diddled by the purser. But actually the story was when they had got to the port in Britain, there was messages there for them as to whether or not America had achieved the quota for Jews for that year. And if they'd achieved the quota, they knew they couldn't unload the Jews in New York. They actually had to unload them in Britain, and so they unloaded them there. My great-grandfather on my mother's side came in the late 1880 to Glasgow, and he realised very quickly it wasn't America and went to America, didn't like it, and came back.
What was your experience of being in Odessa? Like, did you feel any kind of atavistic connection to the city?
It was weird. So there's been this cultural revival in Odessa. I mean, they've gone through a lot. So the Jews of Odessa, a lot escaped after 1905. Then you had the Communist Revolution. Then you had the Holocaust, and a lot of Jews in the Ukraine were murdered. And it's been a revival. So the Jewish population has revived. A lot of Israelis go there. The hotel we stayed in was a very old hotel in Odessa, which has been renovated very well, actually, by some Israeli entrepreneurs. And so there's this revival there. But there's no English. It's all Cyrillic. You can't, if you go into a restaurant, you've just got to work out what's on the menu. And that was really quite exciting. And yes, so the guide was used to taking people like me or us around. And of course, we all want to find the house where people live. And you can't find that anymore. The records are destroyed and so on. But she took us to, she kind of took a history of what our families were like. And she realized that they weren't desperately poor, they were just poor. And if they were just poor, they came from this one particular area, just on the edge of what's now the CBD. And so, and we'd done a lot of touring around, and she's shown us the sites and the steps, which were filmed, the famous Odessan steps, which were filmed in the Battle of the Potemkin movie and so on. It's all this huge romantic stuff. And then maybe day two, she took us to the suburb. And I've shown people photographs of the suburb, and I've said, where is that? And they say, oh, that must be Glasgow. And it looks just like Glasgow tenements. And the irony, the impact, after we'd had all this build-up and she takes it, and she was very clever about how she did it, so there's this big build-up and we get to the place which is generically where they would have come from. And you think, bloody hell. They escaped a pogrom, they get on a boat, use all their savings, get off the boat, and they land where they started.
Well, whereabouts did your family first settle once they were in Glasgow?
They settled in the Gorbals, which is a tenement slum area, a very poor area of Glasgow, just south of the River Clyde. And they settled there and set up businesses. And like most migrant groups, whether they're Indian, Greek, Italian and so on, they work hard. And they slowly moved further south, mostly in Glasgow, to better, more affluent suburbs.
And how did your mum and dad meet, Norman?
My father was a musician, and he ran away from home and played in dance bands during the war and then came back, was cajoled to come back to Glasgow and worked in his father's business. My father and grandfather were terrible businessmen. It completely defeats the stereotype of Jews being good at business. Anyway, my mother was a secretary in the business, and that's how they met.
And what was the business that didn't do too well?
Well, the first business, I think, was something in the rag trade, but the second business was a car yard, a garage, essentially. So it was a garage in the Gorbals. So this just tells you the brilliant marketing mind of my grandfather. As you said, my name was Swirsky. The name on my birth certificate is Swirsky, and it's a name that comes from probably Lithuania, the town of Svirsky, and his name was Sam Swirsky. Just remember that name, Sam Swirsky. So it was a garage which largely served the Jewish community of Glasgow. So we serviced people's cars, also had a second-hand car dealership and so on. Anyway, this is like in the post-war years, post-Holocaust, and my grandfather, Sam Swirsky, called it SS Motors.
He did not.
He did.
Oh, man. What was that about?
No, it would have been just Sam Swirsky's Motors. This makes sense. Why would this be a problem?
And tell me, the Jewish residents didn't flock to SS Motors.
Well, they did. They did, kind of. But I think there was, they went bankrupt in the end, which was a big, huge financial trouble in the family. But the,
Your dad was a musician. What instrument did he play?
Played woodwind, saxophone, clarinet, flute.
Do you remember him playing at home when you were a kid?
Oh yeah, that dominated. He had his own band. And it was his first love. I mean, he hated business and he hated all that stuff, but he did it reluctantly. And he followed the dream when he was younger and then went into business. He hated it, did badly. When it went bankrupt, we really had no money and he couldn't get work. He couldn't get a job. He was out of work. And he changed his name to Swan and he got work the next week. So then he came back to music, which was his first love. He trained as a teacher, got his degrees, and he basically was a music teacher and he had his band. So my father, he was a pretty distant father. He would shut himself in a room and practice for hours on end because he had to find his reeds for the day. For the evening, he would buy a whole heap of reeds for the sax or the clarinet, and then he'd play through them all to work out which ones were the right ones for the evening. And it's just extraordinary. Hours and hours and hours of practice.
When you think back to the Glasgow of your childhood, what do you see? What was it like?
Well, the Jewish community was very self-contained. If I look on my parents' family, I mean, nothing could be different from the life I live now, or have lived really since I went to university. All their friends were Jewish. I don't think they had a single friend who was... My father worked with non-Jewish people. His band was full of non-Jewish people. But their social life was entirely Jewish. We lived maybe 100 metres, maybe 200 metres from the synagogue, one of the synagogues. From the age of four, I'm not religious, but I'm culturally identified being Jewish. But from the age of four, I would just walk down to the synagogue by myself on a Saturday morning and go to the service and sit there.
Age of four?
From the age of four, I can recite the Orthodox Jewish service, almost, you know, parts of it by heart, and the songs and so on. I don't know why I did this. I just went, and really weird, just sitting there and then walked home by myself.
Was it a different kind of atmosphere than at home? Was it a bit of peace and quiet compared to the saxophone and siblings at home?
It could be. I quite like the atmosphere.
Were your parents observant?
That was the era of Jews who were partially observant, very strongly identified with being Jewish. It was partly reflected, you know, post-Holocaust, although Britain did not experience the Holocaust in the way others do. Although the Second World War dominated a lot of life. People, you know, my parents' conversations around the table, Glasgow experienced a blitz of its own, but a lot of people served in the army. I didn't meet Holocaust survivors until I came to Australia. Australia's got a very strong tradition of accepting Holocaust survivors from overseas. You didn't have that in Britain. But it was a very Jewish upbringing in a very non-Jewish city, a very funny city. I mean, Glaswegian sense of humour is fantastic.
Well, what's particular about it?
So you can go into a Glasgow pub and sit down and you'll meet a stranger. People are very friendly. And you'll come out with a sore abdomen because you're laughing so much. They've just got a natural and very funny sense of humour. I kind of aspire to it. And it's quite particular. You see it in Billy Connolly, Billy Connolly at his best. And he really only appealed to Glaswegians. And I remember I ended up at Aberdeen University doing my medical degree. And if Billy Connolly came to town, it was sold out. This is before he was well known. But it was sold out to Glaswegians who lived in Aberdeen. Aberdonians didn't find him that funny. And then he found something happened where he found a way of making himself funny to Aberdonians or people who lived in Edinburgh and so on. He managed to generalise his humour, and that's when he became huge.
You were a kid in Glasgow back in the 1950s, Norman. Did your parents smoke?
Yep, they smoked 20-odd a day. All their friends smoked. You'd go around to your aunt, your great-aunties and so on, and you'd have to sit there as a kid playing in the corner in this literally smoke-filled room where you could barely see people for the smoke. And this conversation where I still don't get it, where these women would get together. They get together on a regular basis, and there was never a moment's silence in the conversation. And even at the age of four or five, I think, I didn't say what the bloody hell, but, you know, if I were saying it now, what the bloody hell have we got to talk about? You know, they just saw each other last week, but still, you know, the gossip and the talk and, you know, do you remember his grand... No, he wasn't there. It wasn't his grandfather. It was his grandfather. And you remember blah, blah, and Nettie was married to so-and-so. Oh, Jesus Christ.
What was on the menu for you as a kid as you fought your way through all that tobacco smoke?
Well, it wasn't the Mediterranean diet, shall I say. I didn't know there was such a thing as olive oil. So my mother had a chip pan. It's called a chip pan. And essentially it was a pan filled with oil, which over the years had accumulated grease on the outside. So it was kind of burnt grease on the outside. And we would have chips once or twice a day.
A day?
Yeah. It was like one meal a day was chips, very rarely not. And a lot of red meat. If we got vegetables, they were mush. Occasionally in summer, you'd have a bit of salad. In the garden, we had raspberry bushes and blackberry bushes. Not blackberries. You'd actually collect blackberries in the countryside. And rhubarb. And so there was a lot of jam making. So we didn't eat the fruit It was sugared in jam. And then there was Jewish cooking as well. So a lot of Jewish cooking, which, look, as I say these things, my mouth waters. You know, this is
really still. You still
programmed
want that food.
You know, I could eat that food really easy. You know, the famous dish, which Australian Jews don't like because it doesn't suit the Australian climate, it's called cholent. Because you weren't allowed to cook on the Sabbath on Saturday, they were slow-cooked dishes. So you'd put them on Friday afternoon and they would be ready by Saturday lunchtime. And one was called cholent. And it's delicious, actually. It's a layer of lamb shanks, beans, potato pudding, potatoes. If there wasn't enough potatoes in it, you'd add potatoes on top of it. Then another layer of lamb shank, blah, 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 blah.
And a side of chips.
You get the idea. There's no chips there. We could not eat chips inside. And the room and the house was filled with the smell of this cooking in the morning. I mean, it was delicious.
What are green beanies, if I'm saying that correctly?
Gribenies.
Gribenies.
And that's a Scottish pronunciation. So Scottish Jews pronounce things slightly differently. So a gribenie, and other people say grivena or something like that, is that you would make your mother would make her own chicken fat for cooking, and it's called schmaltz. And to make your own chicken fat, you had to render the fat from the chicken, and of course the skin is full of fat. So you would cut off the fat from the chicken, and you would cut off the skin. And you cut the skin into strips, and then you'd throw it in, and you'd then cook it at high temperature so that the fat was rendered. And in so doing, the chicken skin became very crispy. And the great treat, oh, and there'd be onions in this as well. And when it was all done, your mother would sieve the fat into a jar for future healthy cooking. And what was left were these crispy onions and chicken skin bits in...
she's going to go and throw up in the corner as you continue with this description.
My mouth is watering right now. And the kids would fight over it.
Oh, God.
Robin Williams, the comic, had a very funny skit on gribenies, which would put you off gribenies for the rest of your life. He referenced it to circumcision. And I won't say any more than that.
When you think back to your mother, Norman, in your early life, is she always in the kitchen? Is that where she spent most of her time? How do you picture her?
My mother was not a happy person. She was thwarted. In another life, she would have been well-educated, gone to university. She was frustrated, unhappy. Sadly, I don't have very fond memories of my mother, nor do my brothers, actually. And looking back, it was just that she was such an unhappy person and frustrated. And so, yep, she was in the kitchen. She was there. When she branched out a little bit later in life and started working, which helped her a lot. But she was an unhappy, quite bitter person.
Did she transfer that sense of unfulfilled potential onto you and your brothers?
No. Well, I don't think my brothers would have to speak for themselves. I think my middle brother suffered most from it, much more so than me or my youngest brother. I think we were fortunate enough to do better at school and get out of it. And, you know, it was quite a toxic environment. So I think my middle brother probably suffered most from it than us. I think that it drove me to want to leave home and do my own thing.
You mentioned earlier that your family changed their name from Swirsky to Swan. How did that change things for your family once they made that transition?
My father got work.
And you think that was connected to the change of name?
It was a coincidence, but there was a fair degree of anti-Semitism in Glasgow. Glasgow's a very divided city by religion. I started medical school at the University of Glasgow. I moved to Aberdeen because I realised what a mistake it was staying at home, so I just worked hard to get good marks so that I could transfer, and I transferred to Aberdeen. But there was no anti-Semitism at university, but there was a fair bit growing up. You know, there's anti-Catholic sentiment, and it was strong in Australia too, but it was very strong there. If you had a strong Protestant family and one of the boys went out with a Catholic girl, you were in trouble and ostracised. It was just awful.
It's interesting, though, that changing the name, and maybe even as a kid you seeing that changing options or opportunities for your dad. I mean, did it teach you something? Was there some kind of lesson you drew from the Swirsky becoming the Swans and things working out a bit better?
Yes. I mean, it's a very vivid memory in my growing up. Now, interestingly, somebody interviewed me for a book on fathers, and I told that story for that book. And my father read the book, and he disagreed. So his memory of that is entirely different. He denied, you know, to the day he died, he denied that's why he changed his name. But I remember the conversations at the table. I remember the frustration. And I remember I was watching this and felt it keenly. And, it kind of reinforced my Jewish identity in many ways, but in a more secular than religious way. It took me a long time to admit in public I was Jewish, by the way. And it's because of that kind of fear of there's an anti-Semitic thing. And it took me a while to actually publicly acknowledge that, to the extent that I still remember my first day at the ABC, a couple of days at the ABC. So nobody knew I was Jewish. And I remember sitting in a program meeting and somebody was praising David Irving. For those listening,
the Holocaust denier.
The Holocaust denier, saying, you know, there was, and I thought, so I didn't rise to it. I didn't bite. But nobody knew I was Jewish. And I just thought, this person who didn't stay very long in the unit I was in, I thought, one day you're going to discover I'm Jewish and you'll remember this conversation. And it was quite interesting. And in those days, there weren't many Jews in the ABC. I'm not saying that was anti-Semitic at all, but there weren't many around. No, there are lots. It was interesting. So I had that tentativeness about prejudice.
You say you went to Aberdeen to study medicine. Was medicine something you wanted to do as a teenager, as you were growing up?
You know, people love to hear the stories of people who become doctors, and it's what I always wanted to be. You know, and I played.
It's my vocation.
I had doctors, played doctors and nurses when I was 2 years old. No, it was not my lifelong ambition. My ambition. I was obsessed with the theatre when I was a teenager. I would go to the Glasgow Citizens Theatre, which was in the Gorbals, actually. Great rep theatre, really one of the world's great rep theatres. And I'd go by myself. I was a member of the theatre club. And I remember seeing Marat Saad in the theatre club with naked actors. And I thought, at the age of 14 or 15, oh, gosh, am I supposed to be here? And I wanted to be an actor.
Why did medicine get you instead?
Try telling a Jewish mother that her doctor, her son, the doctor, is going to be her son, the out-of-work hacker. It doesn't work.
So you went up to Aberdeen to study right up in the north. What kind of place was that?
Aberdeen is a very crisp city. It's
Imagine that's an understatement, is it?
Yes, it's very cool, even in the middle of summer. And it's granite. The buildings are made of granite, so it's got a sort of silver grey to it. Not a depressing grey, but a silver grey to it. It's got a very large fish market. And so the smell of fish pervades the city, actually, and on some days of the year. Not rotten fish, just fresh fish, because it gets transited quite quickly from the fish market to the rest of Britain. It's a very friendly, city, and very, very different from Glasgow. Glasgow's kind of earthy, world champion swearers. You know, you've really got to be an Olympic gold. If you're not an Olympic gold medal swearer, you're really not cutting it. It's one of the frustrations of mine being in broadcasting that I can't vent my usual. So it's a more genteel city. It's quite a wealthy city because of the fish and because of the oil. So it's got poverty, but not as much poverty as Glasgow or even Edinburgh had.
Where did you live when you were studying medicine?
Well, when I first went to Aberdeen, they messed me around and they only accepted me into the medical course a couple of weeks before the course started. And so I couldn't get into college and I got digs. And I went to these digs and I was sharing a bedroom and there was this fearsome landlady who told me that Tuesdays was my day for a bath.
I feel sorry for the person you shared the room with on Monday evening.
His day was Monday. Anyway, I thought, well, if this is it, I'm actually not going to go to university. So I actually turned up at the university and I said, look, I'm going to have to actually bail on this if this is the accommodation you've found me. And they got me a place in college, which was fantastic, made friends and so on. And then with a friend I'd made at college who was Jamaican, we bought a caravan.
What? What do you mean you bought a caravan?
We bought a caravan, a residential caravan with separate rooms on the
Aberdeen.
Beach.
In Aberdeen. It would have been freezing.
I can't tell you. I cannot tell you how cold it was.
Why a caravan, Norman?
Well, it was we thought we didn't want to be moving rental all the time, and we thought, I think he knew somebody in a rental in a caravan, and we could rent it out during the summer. He was quite entrepreneurial, much more entrepreneurial than I was. And so we bought this caravan. So we had this stable accommodation. Well, it's just kind of like 200 or 300 meters from the beach, and this was like 14 miles of white sands, where the North Sea was lapping against the sands. And if you went into the North Sea for longer than 15 seconds, you'd die. Very frustrating.
Did you sleep in bunk beds? What was the setup inside the caravan?
Very good question. So there was a double bedroom, meaning there was a bedroom that just took a double bed and no more. And there was a single bedroom, which took a very small single bed. And we used to roster. But he was a very good-looking Jamaican who played prop for Scottish universities. So he had more luck than I did and had more need of the double bedroom. But our caravan was rather famous.
Despite the excitements of the caravan by the North Sea, you did manage to graduate from medicine. But how did an Ibsen play that you'd seen as a teenager make you take a leap away from the track that you were on? What was the play? Why was it so influential?
So this was going back to my teenage years where I said I'd go by myself. The Glasgow Citizens Theatre were, if you take Brecht, they were considered the best exponents of Brecht outside the Berliner Ensemble. So you saw a lot of Brecht. And if you saw Glasgow in those days, you could see why they would do Brecht. It just made you inside the theatre, you experienced Brecht, and you walked out and you're still in a threatening opera. And they were also great exponents of Ibsen. So they would always have Ibsen as part of the repertoire. Ibsen was kind of a miserable playwright as well. And anyway, they put on Ibsen's last play. Now, nobody ever puts on Ibsen's last play because it's a miserable, long play. But the main character is an Ibsen-like character, writer, and he's nearing the end of his life. He goes to a mountain resort, and a mysterious character comes and takes the writer up the mountain. And the Ibsen character says, "Why? To get to the top and look at the view." And the Ibsen character says, "Well, what will I see?" And the character says, "Well, you've got this view of your life from the top of the mountain, and you will discover that you never lived." Now, I do lots of things on the health report talking about kids when they drink alcohol changing their brain if they do it too quickly. This changed my brain. A new neural network was set up in my brain when this kind of seared into my brain, this comment. And from then on, even till now, the worst thing I could think of in life, I mean, apart from something terrible happening to your children or what have you, is regret. Wishing that you'd done something and getting to a point in your life and you haven't done it. And I decided there and then I wasn't going to do that. So I wanted to do acting. Well, I was thwarted. I could have been stronger and gone and done it, but I didn't. And I did a lot of acting and directing at university, in the Drama Society. And then after I graduated and I was working, I was training in my first year out, I decided, oh, bugger this, I'm going to do an audition for RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, which I failed miserably at.
Can you better remember it?
It's really painful. Mm. Well, you had to do a speech from Shakespeare and a speech from a modern play. And lots of excuses why I did badly, but I just did badly probably because I was never destined to be an actor. And that was fairly traumatic. And I decided, well, okay, I'm going to throw myself back into medicine, and I decided I was going to do paediatrics. And I was really dissatisfied, and I thought, I want to travel a bit, and that's when I came out to Australia. Because if you took a year off, that ruined your career in those days. Nobody looked on it lightly. So I thought, well, nobody will notice. So if I get a really good job in Australia in paediatrics, travel out and then travel back, then it'll all be explicable. And I never went back.
What were your first impressions of Australia when you arrived in Sydney, Norman?
It was very striking and very weird. I travelled out through the United States. This is 1978. And I landed and I looked around and it looked like Britain. It just looked like Britain. But it was very clear this was not Britain. It just looked a bit like it. And if you went into a pub, say in Balmain, which is where I lived, it was like a Glaswegian pub or an Irish pub. But it wasn't. It was very different. And it was like this country that sort of hovered somewhere in the mid-Pacific between, if Britain was on one side and America was on the other, which it wasn't geographically, there was lots of things that felt American, largely because of climate and the better diet and food and so on. And it took me a while to forget that Australia was very, very different and had its own identity, and an identity that was very easy for somebody from Scotland to fit into, very welcoming. It just felt natural.
You joined the ABC as a science reporter and became a dad. You've got three children. Did being a paediatrician make that transition into parenthood any easier?
I don't call myself a paediatrician. I trained in paediatrics. I got my British degrees, but I never got my Australian qualifications to join the...
Let's just say you had more qualifications than I did when I became a parent, Norman.
Sure, sure. My kid's mother, she's a paediatrician. So some of our biggest arguments were over the care of our children. So,
the more relaxed one?
Me. But we never had a GP. Doctors are terrible. We should have had a good GP, and that's what we should have relied on. But no, if our kids had a sniffle, they saw a respiratory paediatrician, they'd have been upset somewhat. We had to see a paediatric gastroenterologist. I mean, it was just embarrassing. And, you heard the story, kids of doctors don't get good care. Our kids got Rolls-Royce care, they'd be much better off with a good GP.
What were you and your family doing in Italy in 2016, Norman?
I've got a little apartment in Italy, just near Perugia. And I took my kids, who are now adults. My middle daughter took her partner, she got married the October beforehand. And we went on a holiday to the apartment. They hadn't been before. And we were all there together and having a great time. And my then wife had a heart condition and she couldn't walk very far. So we hired an electric bike so that she could get to the beach. And I hired an ordinary bike. And we didn't take helmets because we were just going down to the beach and back. And then we got to the beach on the day we'd hired them. And my daughter and my middle daughter and her husband were there. And they said, they were cyclists. They did a lot of cycling. And they said, can we try the electric bike? We never tried one of those before. I said, well, I haven't got helmets. I'm not comfortable with you going along the road, but go up the hill there, and there's no traffic and so on. And sitting there on the beach, about 15 minutes later, my phone goes, and it's my son-in-law, and Anna had crashed against the wall. It's a medieval village, against the wall of the village, and had this terrible bike accident. And my other daughter and I raced to the car and drove to, I knew exactly where it was. And by the time we got there, luckily there was a local passing by, because Mark, my son-in-law, had remembered the number of the emergency number in Italy, but of course couldn't speak in Italian to tell him where it happened. Luckily, a local person was going by and told him exactly where. And when we got there, the paramedic ambulance was already there. Amazing service.
What did you see when you arrived at the accident?
So when my daughter and I got there, relatively few minutes later, is a crumpled bike and my daughter lying with her head probably double its size, bleeding from the mouth, bleeding from everywhere, lots of blood, moaning, and being tended to, being put up by the paramedics, and slowly being put, and my son-in-law standing there, looking as though his world had ended and that his wife was going to die.
Was that your fear too?
I didn't think... I've got a paradox. I've got a fear of death, but it's a quiet fear of death in the middle of the night. When I've been confronted with death, as I have in a couple of times in my own life and in here, is that I kind of lose that fear. And I actually didn't think she was going to die. I had no evidence for that, because she could have quite easily. It was a really bad head injury. But it was horrible, traumatic.
So what were the next steps for her after she was taken away by the ambulance? What kind of rehabilitation or treatment did she go through?
Well, look, I have to praise the Italian system. When you've had a serious incident like that, the risk is that the medical system makes you worse. Makes a mistake and you get worse. The care that she got meant that the worst thing that happened to Anna was the accident. She got amazing care. So my daughter went in the ambulance with Anna, and my son-in-law and I went in the car screaming along the freeway to Perugia Hospital. And luckily I knew somebody at the hospital, professor of medicine there, and I'd phoned ahead and he had smoothed things. The neurosurgical team was waiting. in 20 minutes after the accident, she was out with a neurosurgical team preparing her for theatre. She went to an ICU where she got world-class intensive care. And then they had a world-class neurorehabilitation unit attached to the hospital. I mean, we just lucked out that this could have happened in the mountains somewhere. It could have taken hours. If it had been Sydney, it could have been in the outer suburbs of Sydney and you were taken to the wrong hospital. But just everything worked as it should. But her rehabilitation took years, and she was hospital for 7.5 months, and she eventually got back to Australia, to an Australian hospital a couple of months later.
How's she doing now, Norman?
She's driving. I mean, this is somebody who we're just getting beyond, as we speak, we're just getting beyond the fifth year anniversary of the accident, where for quite some months she didn't know where she was. She was lashing out with frontal lobe behaviour. She was incontinent, couldn't walk. She's driving. She's retrained. She didn't want to go back to her old job, so she's just retrained, got degrees in early childhood teaching, and she's got her first job as an early childhood teacher.
That's incredible. Were you surprised by her grit, by the kind of resilience that she's shown over the last 5 years?
No. If you knew Anna, she's one of the most taskful. She always has been. She was the kid who, if she had something to do, learn to ride a bike, blah, blah, blah. She was completely focused and she had to achieve it and do it in sport and swimming and so on. Gave her a task, she had to do it. Grim determination. I've never heard a moment's self-pity from her. Why is it me? Why am I doing this? Having a moan. When she had to learn to walk, she learned to walk. She just went through the pain and the discomfort and grittily determined to do it.
Back on that day of the accident, what happened when you were explaining the situation to your other two kids at the hospital?
So there was no waiting room for families. You had to go to the main cafeteria. And so I'd just been in with the neurosurgeon. And, just one look at the neurosurgeon, in two words with him, you just knew that that's fine. I'll let my daughter be operated by him. And everything was being done, as you'd expect. And anyway, I then, by this time, the family had gone to the canteen and I came back in and they're all sitting there, including Mark. And I'm recounting what happened. I described all this that I've just described to you. And I just said, look, everything was right. Everything was absolutely right. And then I realised what I'd said. And then I said, except Anna. And I started to cry. And when Jonathan and Georgia, my youngest, saw me starting to cry, I saw them starting to lose it. And I thought, shit, I can't do this. I really can't do this. And I stopped because they just looked on with horror as they saw me crying. And I got a grip and stopped. Now, there's this kind of Hollywood thing about psychology, which is, a Hollywood movie where you keep it bottled up and it comes from sort of Freudian psychoanalysis and you've got this secret and eventually you've got this catharsis and you let it all out and the world is fine after that. It's complete bullshit. It is complete bullshit. There's no known value in this. Yes, you can have trauma-guided therapy, but trauma-guided therapy is actually not about revisiting the trauma. It's just acknowledging that somebody's had trauma, but you don't expose the trauma, and trauma-guided therapy is not about reliving the trauma. Anyway, so I bottled it up. And
what, in that moment when you saw the reaction from your kids, you thought, I've got to keep it together?
I've got to keep it together because they didn't have to articulate it. I just knew they were lying to me. And I phoned a friend of mine who's a professor of psychology in Scotland, who I grew up with, first of all, because she knew Anna really well, and to tell her about it, but also to recount that story. And she said, well, you did the right thing. Just remember the Glaswegian saying. And I said, what Glaswegian saying? Keep your shit wired tight. And this was from a psychologist. There's no benefit to letting it hang out. When you've got to actually get through stuff.
What about post the fact, though, Norman? Like, it's such a huge thing to arrive at an accident scene and see your daughter so injured and then the years of recovery. Have you needed to talk about it since? Have you needed to, like, unwire that a little bit as the years have gone by?
I haven't. Well, look, I did at one point, but not it was probably an accumulation of life events, as often occurs. I've had post-traumatic stress syndrome before. I was in a bus that blew up when I was at the age of 14. Luckily, nobody died in it, but several of us almost died in it.
Tell me about that. What happened at that accident?
I was in this youth club and we'd been on a trip to England, south of England, and we were driving back. It was Easter Monday and the bus broke down. So nobody could get out of the bus. And the drivers of the bus worked out the petrol wasn't getting to the carburetor and the engine's inside the cabin of the bus. And they brought a can of petrol inside the bus to siphon petrol directly into the carburetor. And it backfired. And by that time, the bus was filled with petrol fumes and it blew. And I ended up unconscious, hanging from a window with my trousers burning, and was in hospital with burns for quite some time. And I, through my adolescence, I had what you would now recognise as PTSD.
Was it recognised at the time by anyone?
No. I mean, the fact that I was having nightmares, reliving it, it was just considered a bit of a psychological reaction, and you'll get over it. I mean, for example, so one reflection of that, which actually I still have to this day, which is if I go into an enclosed space, I actually feel claustrophobic and I work out how I would get out in an emergency, because that was an issue. I delayed working out how I'd get out of the bus just for a few seconds too long. So I've still got a bit. And I mean, it came back a bit after, and nothing as bad, but I was getting flashbacks and having bad dreams and things like that.
And so how did you get through that? What was your approach to that?
Well, you know, one of the first things you learn in medicine is do as I say, but not as I do. I just went through it. I'd been through it before, I knew what I was experiencing. It wasn't a mystery.
But what does getting through it look like? Does it mean exercising more? Does it mean drinking more? Does it mean taking a holiday? How does Norman get through it?
People were asking me that at that time. I'm not a drinker and didn't resort to drinking or anything like that. I've always taken a lot of exercise. I probably threw myself into work, got very busy. I certainly threw myself into Anna's rehabilitation and participating in that. It probably wasn't good for the people around me. But I wasn't convinced that talking it through with somebody and reliving it was actually going to solve the problem.
Does it sort of shift your sense of yourself? And I think about someone, I think particularly for doctors, but just someone who's got a certain authority in the world and has a sense of self, of being in control and being able to make decisions, to kind of have your emotions knocked around like that. Is it a little bit disorientating on a deeper level?
It is. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's not the first time I had a conversation like this with someone. I got through it. But I did end up going to see a clinical psychologist because too many things were building up and I was feeling really bad and I was in a place where I was losing that control. And a friend of mine who's a psychiatrist recommended this clinical psychologist who he'd been to see. So I went to see this clinical psychologist who was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. So he was used to dealing with men who can be utterly pathetic, and I'm one of them. You know, the whole thing about having the Y chromosome is that you can't multitask and you don't read a map. But anyway, he knew what he was dealing with. He was fantastic. And there was no digging up of old trauma because he knew the story. There was no point in digging up the old trauma. It was there front and center. And he just gave me some practical pathways through this, very practical pathways, which took you beyond where you were now. And so the way he did it was to say, imagine you're feeling better and you've actually got through what you're going through now. And I promise you, you are going to get through it. Let's just visualize what life is like when you've got through it. What's it like? And so I listed a few things, which is, you know, catch up with friends, maybe do a bit more writing, blah, blah, blah. He said, well, what's stopping you doing that now? I said, well, nothing, I suppose. He said, well, what are you doing on Saturday night? I said, well, you're asking me out. He said, no. arrange your Saturday night. Phone up friends. Go out. He said, you just got to plan that stuff now. You've got to be a bit more deliberate about it than you were before because you're just in this funk. And just that process of living the future life now, I was going forward to a time when I was better, but the time I was better was actually Saturday night, not some mythical time in the future. It was brilliant.
That resolve that you showed in the hospital cafeteria to stay cool and stay in control, is that also how you see your role for the nation during this pandemic?
Yes, is the short answer to that question. I mean, you don't do people any favours about showing the same things that they're going through. They're seeing that, you know, and experiencing that every minute of the day, trying to homeschool the kids, having to live with less money, going through that trauma, the uncertainty of the future. They do not need to see, it does nobody any favours of sharing. Looking like that is actually using the audience as a crutch rather than saying, look, I've got this and I've got the information here. I've talked to the experts in the area. Here's what they say. I'm going to tell you it straight. Some of it's not great news. Some of it's okay. We will get through it, et cetera, et cetera. But not displaying the fact that I'm feeling the same as them. They would know that, but I don't need to show it.
Tell me about the little boy, Hark, who rang in to live talk back earlier on in the pandemic. What did he want to know?
We realised almost by accident on CoronaCast, and we were getting tens of thousands of questions. So I think we had 220,000 questions up till June of 2020. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And they were kind of thermometers of the temperature of the nation, changing day by day. And we got a lot of parents writing in about their kids and what the kids were going through. And we did a CoronaCast for kids, which was really very touching, and we tried to make it funny as well. And on Victorian radio, we did a talkback with kids. And most of the questions were nice little cute questions. But this little kid phones up, and he's 8 or 9 years old. Hi, I'm Huck. Dr. Swan, I want to know, is my family going to die? And when a kid like, and some, you know, it's partly a paediatric training, but also just when a child says that, you realise there's nothing else actually in the world. You have this tunnel vision. I'd be sitting in a studio with just a microphone in front of me. I can't see this child, but I'm visualising this child, and you think, I've got to deal with this. And then I started just asking this little boy about his family and parents and his sister and his grandma and grandpa and so on. And I was able to say with utter confidence that, you know, they're going to be fine. Don't worry, they are going to be fine. But I just realised what trauma some of these kids are going through. And the parents hadn't fully realised what he was going through. They knew he was doing it tough. And subsequently, those parents have actually been in touch with, and grandmother, so have been in touch with me and talked about him, and, you know, and he's doing really well. But that really rocked me.
Were there points over the last 18 months when you've been genuinely scared about what this virus could mean?
Yes. Well, right from the beginning, I knew this was going to be bad. I mean, I'm not doing what I'm doing because I've come to this laterally. When I was at medical school, two of my favourite subjects were public health and epidemiology and social medicine. So medicine is a social science. You get some politicians saying, oh, doctors shouldn't be talking about politics, it's outside their lane, you know, stick to your lane, which is writing out prescriptions and examining people. Well, let me tell you, medicine quintessentially is a social science. If you separate medicine from society, from the way people live, from how much money they've got in the pocket, how much education they get, you're not a good doctor. So that drives me always. And then when HIV came along, I was probably one of the first people in Australia to start covering HIV. And I did a television series on pandemics for Channel 4 and Film Australia here. It's been shown in about 27 countries, which was about the origin of pandemics. And it was framed against HIV, where people thought, well, this is the first pandemic to hit humankind, when I knew it wasn't the first and it wasn't going to be the last. And so that was in the late 80s, early 90s, I made that series. And so I've always been interested in pandemics and how they occur and the history of pandemics. And when this one came along, there was no surprise. I was ready for it. The thing about a pandemic is that the germ, we all focus on the coronavirus. The germ is the least important part of a pandemic. It's how we live that creates pandemics. The bat that threw off this coronavirus, and it probably was a bat, if it had thrown off this coronavirus 10 years ago, there would not have been a pandemic. I would say that with utter confidence.
Why not?
Because it wasn't a world ruled by authoritarian men with fragile personalities, with an unprecedented lack of multilateral cooperation. It landed on a world with Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin, Donald Trump, Bolsonaro, Orban and others, where it was every nation for themselves, and you had a cowering population in China who were afraid to speak up, and they'd forgotten the lessons of SARS-1. If it had been 10 years ago, they'd have probably opened up and controlled things. This is a pandemic caused by politics.
Was this health guide that you've written, Norman, a kind of light relief from
coronavirus? Yeah, it was occupational therapy. I actually don't see it as a health guide, by the way. I mean, I think that's what's on the front page. It's not a health guide.
It's
essentially trying to cut through the bullshit for people. I mean, everybody's anxious about something to do with their health. I'm not getting 8 hours sleep. I'm going to get dementia. I've got insomnia. We've got a pandemic of insomnia because people are worried about insomnia. How much fat should I eat? How much carbohydrate? What supplements should I be having? I mean, just worried about stuff you don't need to worry about. To saying it's a health guide means I'm guiding you in your health. And actually, if you're looking for that, don't buy this book. That's not what I'm doing. What I'm doing here is actually presenting you with the stuff to make up your own decisions.
I guess you are living proof that a childhood of passive smoking and fried chicken fat doesn't condemn a person to a lifetime of ill health.
I'm hoping not.
Thank you so much for being my guest today.
It's been my pleasure.
I spoke with Dr. Norman Swan in 2021 in the midst of the pandemic and while he was still presenting CoronaCast. Norman had just published the book So You Think You Know What's Good For You, and he's now written 2 follow-up books, So You Want to Live Younger, Longer, and So You Think You Know What's Good For Your Kids. And the wonderful Tegan Taylor is, of course, now presenter of Life Matters on Radio National. This episode of Conversations was produced by Nicola Harrison, and the executive producer was Carmel Rooney. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.